All this week, we've been learning more about 26-year-old Aaron Swartz, the internet genius who committed suicide last week while facing federal charges for stealing millions of articles from a computerized archive at MIT. Swartz's lawyers and family blame his death on what they call an overzealous prosecutor. Yesterday, the U.S. attorney in Boston, Carmen Ortiz, broke her silence and said prosecutors had been fair in the case. She said that offered Swartz a plea deal of 30 days in a minimum security prison. Today, we want to take a more personal look at Aaron Swartz through the eyes of his friend, journalist and historian Rick Perlstein. They met when Swartz offered to build Perlstein a website for free. Rick writes about their friendship in The Nation. And Rick, your column paints a picture of an exceptional young man. And if we did our math correctly, he first reached out to you when he was in his teens.
I think he must have been around 20. It was kind of a mystery to me. A lot of things about him were kind of a mystery to all of us. He just didn't quite seem like anyone else we'd ever met.
And already a technical genius by that point. In fact, you sent us, Rick, to the dictionary when you described him as, and here I'm quoting you, a ball of pure coruscation. In other words, a flash of light, a sparkle, glitter, someone with sparkling virtuosity. Tell us about that side of Aaron Swartz.
I got to tell you about that by moving you away from the notion that he was just a technological genius. I mean, I'm a historian. You know, I can barely turn on my computer. I write history. I write about politics. And the reason he sought me out was because he wanted to know more about those things. One of the stories he told me was about the time he was very briefly in college at Stanford, and he went to a history course, and the professor said, oh, well, the reason that America was in the Vietnam War was to fight communism. And immediately, Aaron had leapt down his throat and said, well, no, actually, the U.S. government's own documents in 1975 said we were just there to kind of save face and prove ourselves worthy guarantors. And here he was quoting the Pentagon Papers to this Stanford college professor, you know, very soon after he's leaving college because he realizes that the people around him just don't share the intensity of his intellectual convictions.
And he had that knowledge at the tip of his tongue.
He had that knowledge at the tip of his tongue, and he had that passion at the tip of his tongue. What we see in that exchange is a kind of moral passion to get it right, to cut beyond the cliches in which most of us kind of lazily organize the world. I mean, this is a guy who was always searching for the correct answer as a way of making a moral point, as a way of making the world a better place.
Rick, you also tested our Yiddish when you wrote that Aaron was a Luftmensch, and the best definition we found of that was an impractical, contemplative person having no definite business or income. And along the same lines, you say that he was a public intellectual without portfolio. Was this a young man of the mind struggling to find his place in the world?
Well, he certainly was a young man of the mind, but he was also a beautiful writer. And he wrote about the time he realized that he couldn't see street signs anymore. If you don't mind, I'll read an amazing piece of his writing.
Sure, this is when he realized he needed contact lenses.
Right, that he was legally blind. He said, I looked up and realized that I couldn't read the street sign. I definitely used to be able to read that sign, but there it was, big and bright and green along the highway, and all I could make out was a blur. I had gone blind. And then he got his contact lenses. And this is what he wrote. He said, I had no idea the world really looked like this with such infinite clarity. It looks like a modernist photo or a hyper-real film, everything in focus everywhere. Everyone kept saying, oh, do you see the leaves now? But the first thing I saw was not the leaves, but the people. People, individuated, each with brilliant faces and expressions and gaits. The sun streaming down upon them. I couldn't help but smile. It's much harder to be a misanthrope when you can see people's faces. I think you can see in that the kind of agape he shared for the world and his fellow human beings. I mean, this is not just some nerd living in a basement writing computer code.
But was he also a self-described misanthrope?
I think one of the many things he kind of willed himself not to be, and he was an extremely strong-willed person, was someone who wasn't a misanthrope. I mean, to the extent that he was extremely, extremely enraged at the unfairness and the injustice he saw around him. And he wrote a very kind of widely read post about how to be more productive. And he said, of course, the best way to do that is to choose the right parents and choose the right privileged circumstances. But you can't do that. And so here is some advice for you, because I want to make things more fair. Fairness was his guiding passion. It was really extraordinary.
Rick, even the many people who adored Aaron say that he could be difficult. Was that your experience?
No, it wasn't. I had a slightly different experience than most, in that he kind of came to me not to challenge me, but to kind of learn from me because my particular area of expertise.
The media coverage of Aaron's death often references his struggles with depression. Did you see signs of that?
No, and as a matter of fact, when I last time I saw him talked about my own depression, he didn't really seem to kind of respond as a fellow traveler. I think the most famous thing he wrote about his depression was, you know, 2007 when he was a teenager. And at the memorial service, his own father talked about this. And one of the reasons I got to see him so often was because his mother was sick and in the hospital in my neighborhood at the University of Chicago Hospital. And his mother, who's a lovely woman who I met yesterday, came near to death with several medical conditions. And when his father pointed out at the memorial services, he came through that just fine. And his father really wanted to stress the notion that really what pushed him to the edge was being trapped by this extremely insensitive and unjust federal prosecution.
Which, of course, is the view of his family. Although the prosecution says it dealt with this correctly. Did Aaron ever talk to you about his legal troubles with federal prosecutors involving this MIT hacking case?
No, I think one of his greatest frustrations was that he couldn't talk to his friends about it. You know, this is the nature of an ongoing legal proceeding. Of course, now we know that the negotiations being carried out by the assistant U.S. attorney in Massachusetts were brutal. I mean, they were forcing him to plead guilty to a felony, which he refused to do, to take 6 months in prison. And by the way, in the negotiations, they said that they would put him up in a minimum security prison. But according to his mother, that was never a possibility because the medical conditions he suffered, only a maximum security prison would have had the medical facilities that he would have required. And he was just terrified at spending 6 months at a maximum security prison. I mean, his mother told me that she was afraid that had he ended up in prison, he would have hung himself there.
Because of all of this, how Aaron is remembered will be complicated. How do you hope he's remembered?
I hope he's remembered in the way he's overwhelmingly being remembered. He's being remembered by his friends and his fellow activists and people who didn't know him as an inspiration to continue his work, which is to make information as free as possible, to break down unjust institutions, and to keep alive the dream that another world is possible.
That's journalist and historian Rick Perlstein, a friend of Aaron Swartz. Rick, thank you.